You and I would always be upset if we found that some people who were vulnerable were taken advantage of. You know what it's like when those people go around to pensioners' homes and force them into tough contracts to fix their roof or whatever. What if that happened on a statewide, a national, or an international scale, where corporations take advantage of the vulnerable to turn huge profits? Wouldn't that be horrific? Well, it's happening, and to talk about just those sorts of events and how that's affecting us here in WA, I'm joined by Anthony Lowenstein, who's an esteemed colleague, a great journo, a filmmaker, a photographer, a widely travelled foreign correspondent, and contributor to many of Australia's top press outlets. Anthony, first of all, welcome, and it's great to speak with you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Mate, you've done some really great work over many years, and you don't mind digging into places that are often secret. And that's pretty much at the heart of what we're talking about. The secret life of major corporations, international corporations, in our own backyard to profit from other people's doom. And we're talking about companies like Serco, for instance, aren't we? You've been having a look at them pretty much soon after, just a couple of days after the Prime Minister Tony Abbott has confirmed that details of our asylum seekers, their arrivals and where they go, are going to be secret. Thankfully, you've been digging before that particular veil went up.
One of the things that I think a lot of Australians might not be aware of is that during the Howard years, during the Labor years, and now obviously the early days of the Abbott Liberal coalition government, refugees and asylum seekers are housed in detention centres that are run by private corporations. During the Howard years, the Conservative years, those 12 years, 11 and a half years, they were mostly American companies and British companies, earning pretty nice profits. So the more people who are in those beds, the more asylum seekers that arrive, the higher the profits. Fast forward to the Labor year starting in 2007, and we should not forget that when Labor was in opposition, this was Kevin Rudd and Tony Burke, who was an immigration minister recently, and Julia Gillard, who of course was Prime Minister, amongst other positions. They all railed against the idea of a private corporation making money from asylum seekers for obvious reasons, and they were correct. Of course, they never implemented this in reality, but their argument was, how can you have a situation where people's lives are being determined by a corporation whose only and primary interest is turning a profit? Labor comes into power in 2007. By 2009, we shouldn't forget that the refugee flow was relatively small. Serco, the British multinational, whose record both in WA, in the UK, in many countries is unbelievably appalling, and yet it's become one of the handful of corporations that countless governments around the world use to sell off services too. So this could be hospitals, like it's happening in WA, in your state. It could be in detention centres. It could be in juvenile justice. And the weird thing about this is that I have, in a book I just released called Prophets of Doom, interviewed countless people who work for Serco and the asylum seekers. I went to Curtin in WA and Christmas Island, which is 3 hours, as people will know, from Perth by plane, that a senior Serco manager, who remains a Serco manager, gave me lots of documents and told me a lot about the internal culture within Serco. And in short, in very quick summary, saying how there is a culture of contempt towards those who are more vulnerable. The profit motive, of course, is the key. And the problem is that the contract that the Australian government, the Labor government, signed with Serco in 2009, that has been constantly changed over the years as more and more boats have been coming and more people are in detention, allows, in theory, a great deal of accountability. In practice, there is virtually no oversight, which is, almost goes without saying, but that is a complete disaster for both the guards and also asylum seekers.
People here in Perth would have read only recently where the WA Police Union has been asking the Barnett government to do something about Serco dumping prisoners that are in their charge at police stations, where our overworked police officers are already dealing with massive cell overcrowding and shortage of staff. In addition to that, Anthony, we've been reading stories as well in the last few years, like the one of the death of the Indigenous elder out in the goldfields in horrific circumstances in a desert van journey. We've also heard about up on Christmas Island, where the staff there were so badly trained, they were in fear for their lives in many cases, and admitted in some cases that their lack of training put the lives of not only themselves, the inmates, and the locals of Christmas Island at risk. So this is not some really slick commercial operation. This is a mess we're talking about, and a mess, I might add, that over in the UK is under investigation for fraud.
Indeed, and one of the crazy things about this situation is this is also bipartisan, that this is not really a question of Labor's in power, it's worse, the Coalition's in power, it's worse. There's no doubt in WA the Barnett government has arguably become, in my view, in my investigation's view, the worst example, certainly on the state government-wide in this country, in Australia, of outsourcing and privatising, and Serco has been a major beneficiary of that, and we shouldn't forget how that actually works. Most of the process is not illegal. The lobbying that goes on by Serco is mostly not illegal. It involves, for example, sending over countless WA ministers and officials. This is on both sides of the aisle, but at the moment, particularly in WA, of course, the Barnett government's in power, and on lobbying trips to the UK, where these politicians like Troy Buswell and others come back, extolling the virtues of how wonderful Serco is, and surprise, surprise, Serco gets a lot of the business. But it's not just Serco, it's also G4S, and the individual you mentioned before, Mr. Ward, the Indigenous man who died in the back of a van. G4S is now running detention centres in Manus Island and Papua New Guinea. Its record of managing asylum seekers during the end of the Howard years was appalling, which is exactly why they were dumped as a provider. Serco was then brought in as a supposed better alternative. The problem is that, and you mentioned the training issue, all these issues in the contract are stipulated in a certain way. And there's theory and there's rhetoric and there's reality. The reality is, in all these sort of cases, whether it's asylum seekers, juvenile justice, and others, hospitals, the care that actually is being shown by many of the corporations is incredibly bad. And the issue, I think, is that whenever the general public is asked, in most states in Australia, including, I might add, overseas as well, they are opposed to privatisation. They're opposed to water being privatised. They're opposed to electricity. They're opposed to many things being privatised. And yet, despite that, both politicians on both sides of politics feel comfortable outsourcing in the argument of, well, it's more efficient, it's cheaper. It's actually neither of those. And the trauma that people suffer on both sides, both in the detention centre issue, asylum seekers, but also the guards. And I spoke to many guards, what they're experiencing. They're often thrown into appallingly volatile situations in remote detention centres with very little training, if any training. And not surprisingly, they suffer mental trauma themselves when they are seeing, for example, kids trying to self-harm or adults trying to commit suicide. This is happening on a day-to-day basis. And the reason many of the public do not know this is because the centres that the government has put in the middle of nowhere are there for a reason. They're in the middle of nowhere because most journalists don't go there, can't be bothered, it's hard to get to. It's very hard to get into these centres, as I found myself. I did get access to it, but it's difficult. The government doesn't want people to see and hear the stories and humanise people's lives, asylum seekers especially. It's much easier to demonise people when they are this homogenous mass of queue jumpers or terrorists or whatever we're told is the new message of the day. So the outsourcing, I think, has allowed corporations to be benefiting. And this, in closing, what's weird and ironic is we're told by both sides of politics that we're trying to break the people smugglers' business model. This is the main argument we're constantly sold, why there needs to be crueler and crueler ways to manage asylum seekers. Ironically, there are countless corporations who are benefiting financially from this situation. So the powers that be aren't that concerned about people making a profit. The issue is who's making a profit and how. And I think there needs to be far more examination by particularly the media and others into why we are giving contracts to failing and failed corporations who are doing an appallingly bad job with our tax dollars, I might add.
That's been making news recently, Anthony, that is really worrying a lot of us, is that with the loss of West Australia's AAA credit rating, the response from Premier Barnett and his fairly incompetent front bench is, well, we're going to sell off more assets and privatise more things. So it's actually more likely now that Serco is going to make even more profits, and other companies that do profit from doom are going to make a lot more money, and yet we won't get the services. People will be treated badly. In some cases, it will cost their lives, in many cases, their health. So there is a great deal to be concerned about.
There is, and I think I'd say to people in Western Australia, and I've been saying this to various people as I'm going around the country and overseas talking about some of these corporations, is that be aware of the fact that most people in our community are opposed to what is happening. The issue is the separation between what people think and what they talk about with their friends and colleagues and actually what they're able to do politically. There's a sense, I think, of people feeling disempowered. Or, yes, I'm opposed to Serco running Fiona Stanley Hospital in just outside Perth. Or I'm opposed to Serco running certain centres in WA. But what can I do about it? I'm one person. And obviously there are refugee groups that are opposing these things, and I applaud their work, but they're relatively small. And I think there are many other groups, a lot of unions in WA particularly are opposing that. And I think you'll find, as you rightly say, as the Barnett government uses the flawed logic of outsourcing to deal with a financial issue, that they're actually going about it the wrong way. And there needs to be, in my view, serious civil disobedience against those kind of policies because they don't work. And unfortunately, I wish the Labor opposition was far more vigorous since opposition to that, as their title would suggest, being opposition. But like so many cases around Australia, the Labor and Liberal parties are far too close to each other on these kind of issues because they both believe in outsourcing and privatisation in general.
In the election recently, it's a case of dumb and dumber, and that's becoming more clear. The other part of the horrific state finances is our loss of the AAA credit rating has been laid squarely at the feet of the Premier, because despite the mining boom and more money going offshore and more of his corporate mates getting filthy rich, that because of the failure to predict what everyone had predicted, that the mining boom wouldn't last forever and salt money away. In fact, what has been salted away doesn't even cover the cost of the debt to finance it. So it looks like the corporations are winning, but it doesn't look like, as you suggested, the Labor Party is going to be much better. We're going to take a short break, Anthony, and when we come back, we'll talk more about that, but also about the goings-on up at James Price Point that most of our listeners would be aware of. And I'm looking forward to canvassing that with you.
Thank you.
I'm talking with Anthony Lowenstein, and he's not only a colleague, a very well-respected journo. If you've been listening in so far, you think, oh, he's just another one of those lefty latte-sipping blokes from the inner city over in Sydney or Melbourne. Well, not so. Very much like my years when I was younger, he's been out on the road in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in the Middle East, in Haiti after the disasters there. And you've been around and seen a lot of things, and I guess from the title of your new book, Prophets of Doom, which also relates to WA, it relates to the global experience and reminded you, obviously, that in so many places, whether it's war, disaster or whatever, there are multinational corporations making literally billions of dollars.
Well, that's one of the things I was looking at. You're absolutely right, is that post 9/11 there's been a fundamental shift in the ways in which the state, particularly the US and other states, including Australia, manage wars or aid or resources. Now, there's always been people looking to make money and make a fortune from misery. That's not in itself new. It's the nature of human nature, I would argue. However, what's changed post 9/11, and this was led by the Bush administration at the time and many other countries followed suit and still do to this day, including the Obama administration, which has changed very little, in fact, not much at all in relation to these kind of questions, that when you are hiring private corporations to run your wars, when you are hiring private corporations to do special forces jobs, i.e. assassination jobs, you are guaranteeing abuses, you are guaranteeing human rights outrages. And it's not just me saying this, this is countless US government reports themselves which detail this. And one of the things that was remarkable, there was a US Congress report that came out a few weeks ago. And since 2001, the US invaded in October 2001 Afghanistan. Obviously, they're talking about pulling out the vast majority of troops by the end of 2014. In those years, the US has given at least $90 billion of aid. And this report said, and I'm giving obviously a very brief summary, it said there is still no procedures in place to actually manage or assess how effective the aid was. Now, you think when you're spending that much money, there may be some checks and balances, and there really hasn't been. And what's remarkable is that this is also happening in many other parts of the world as well. So what I look at in the book is to say that we always have this idea, I think, in the West that more aid is better, that the more money we give through aid organisations to Afghanistan, PNG, Haiti, whatever it may be, we're actually helping the local people there. And there's no doubt that some of the aid that we do give helps maternal health issues or other areas of need. But the problem is too much of that money is going to corruption. Too much of that money is going to Western contractors who go to those countries earning a fortune and rarely, if ever, empowering local groups or individuals. The effect of that is that when those groups and individuals pull out, which they inevitably do, what's left? And we saw that in PNG. Some listeners may have watched the Four Corners program recently, which talked all about Papua New Guinea and the reality of what our aid money is doing. And one of the things I think a lot of people maybe aren't aware of is that we're constantly pushing as an Australian government, and again, it doesn't matter who's in power, whether it's Labor or the Coalition, pushing the mining agendas and mining corporations to invest in developing countries, despite the fact that mining rarely, if ever, helps local people. And that, to me, should be a key component of what we're trying to do over there in PNG or elsewhere, or closer to home, for that matter, in Australia. And one of the things they also look at, which is much closer to your listeners in WA, is James Price Point and the Kimberley, which I think no one quite knows exactly how much, but there is under the Kimberley insane amounts of mineral wealth, amazing amounts of mineral wealth. There are many corporations that are pretty damn keen to get their hands on that. And the James Price Point battle that was, I guess, won of sorts by various groups earlier on this year, where there was not going to be an onshore gas plant built by Woodside, that battle has now shifted to a wider one where the greater war, which is still going to be fought, is who is going to have the rights. Is an Abbott government, is a Barnett government, are other forces very keen to give rights and remove environmental regulations and safety assessments to exploit the Kimberley? And that, to me, is something I think many Western Australians will be pretty damn upset about.
Anthony, I'm not sure if you've been up to the Kimberley, but I can tell you, and I've mentioned it a few times to listeners here, that despite all the billions that have been ripped out of the soil in the Kimberley and the Pilbara and the goldfields, up north there in the indigenous communities, we still have 70% of the children with glue ear. We have 40% of the children with eye problems. We don't have basic water, power or health services. So not only have we seen our AAA credit rating squandered by the government for decades, we have the owners, the custodians of the land, who are suffering fourth world conditions up there. Kids are suffering. And the whole argument of, oh, we have to develop and there's too much red tape, too much green tape, it's so obscene. Have you been up there and seen some of the conditions?
I have. I've spent quite a lot of time in the Kimberley. In my book, actually, I discuss that, and I've also been there on some of the trips as well. So I have certainly spent time there. I've seen the reality of what is happening in indigenous communities, and it is, as you say, outrageous. And the idea somehow that a solution to that, and this, of course, was what James Price Point was partly about, although not solely, was indigenous communities were split, as listeners may remember, where some indigenous leaders supported it and some did not. And the reason that some supported it was they were saying, we as a community need help. We have major problems, which is true. Woodside and the Barnett government will give us a lot of money if we support this gas plant on our land. And cut a long story short, of course, that plant's not going to go ahead. But it seems, I remember a few months ago at a Q&A on ABC TV, there was Bob Brown and Colin Barnett. And I remember Bob Brown was saying, and I'm paraphrasing here when they were talking about James Price Point, why does it require a dirty, polluting, environmentally disastrous project to happen before Indigenous people get what they deserve anyway? Why does it require that kind of outrageous plan, which was opposed, I might add, by a range of groups, black and white, in the Kimberley and beyond, to actually receive health services and education, which was the way Woodside and the Barnett government framed it? And now that the project has fallen over, as listeners will be very aware, Colin Barnett has been coming out this week, getting interviews to the Australian newspaper, showing outrage still that the plan did fall over, and refuses to accept the fact that Woodside and Shell want to now talk about having a gas plant offshore, which is still problematic, I might add, but less environmentally destructive. So I think Colin Barnett's something we're listening particularly well, and the effect, I think, of that is that I fear that with an Abbott government now looking to, as you said, inverted commas, cut red tape, we have environmental problems only getting worse in your part of the world, and indeed in mine.
Yes, we are indeed. And, mate, despite the problems we've got over here, you're going to head west before long, mate. I understand you're going to be over here in October. Tell us about that.
I'm coming at the end of October, in the last days of the month. I'm doing a book tour for Prophets of Doom. I'm being invited by Curtin University, so I'm doing a few events with them. And then I'm doing an event at the Perth State Library with Scott Ludlam, who is a Green Senator from WA, as people will know. So if people want to find out more about that, if they can just go on Facebook, they can put in my name. They can go to anthonylowenstein.com, which is my website. They can go for information about the book to prophetsofdoombook.com. I'm also a weekly columnist now for The Guardian, and people can just go to The Guardian website and put my name in there too. So all this sort of stuff I've written about and spoken about. So yes, so look forward to coming over. I've spent quite a lot of time in WA. I look forward to returning.
Mate, I'll buy you a choc milk when you get here. I've been looking forward to catch up with you for some FaceTime, mate. I'll be at least a couple of the events you'll be over here, being a good friend and supporter of Scott Ludlam. And I would direct people, too, to follow you on Twitter at Ant Lowenstein. And in case you don't have a pen handy, if you follow me, Perth Tones, on Twitter, as this goes to air, I'll be posting out some links to Anthony's website, his blog, and his Twitter handle as well. And I'll tell you why I do that, because Anthony makes me feel like a tired old lazy journo, because he's all over the place. He's spent a lot of time in the Middle East, and you do a great deal of work, and you've got some other books that I would suggest people have a look through your blog and have a look at the titles and read them, because they will find that what they've heard me say has been not so much echoed by your writings and your work over the last decade or so, but totally outpaced. And you do a power of work, mate. What drives you on?
Look, it's a good question. People often ask me, and I guess there's no simple answer, so without wishing to rant on, I guess really I'm having traveled a lot around the world and also spent a lot of time here in my own country of Australia. I think the stories that generally inspire me are not people who you and I have heard of. They're communities in, for example, PNG that I spend time with, or people who are, I don't idealise communities that are local, but people who are resisting, for example, appalling mining projects or whatever it may be, or resisting what's happening in Afghanistan, or for that matter, local communities in Australia and WA who oppose the James Price Point plans, which were opposed, I might add, by the vast majority of citizens from across the board in your state, WA. I think what also drives me is I guess I have a lot of energy. I'm pretty pissed off with how I think most of the media works in Australia. I think it's pretty lazy. I think it's very insular. I think it's conservative. I've got no issue with conservative press. I don't agree with its politics, but it has every right to exist like a liberal left-wing press. The problem is that too much journalism, I think, these days is uncritical. And I often talk about journalists have a choice to be insiders or outsiders, and embedded or unembedded. And embedded does not just mean literally being with, you know, American troops in Afghanistan. It's also a mindset and it's a psychological choice where you choose to be on the drip feed of public relation, and too much of the media that we read actually is a press release rewritten, if it's even rewritten at all. And listeners will often feel that, I'm sure. So all those reasons to say it's possible to be an independent journalist in Australia not to be on a corporate drip feed. And yes, I write now for The Guardian every week, which is a great opportunity. I write for other publications as well. And I hope that gives some kind of answer, but it's never complete, is it? But that's the best I can do right now.